From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, who's Alex Jones? Stand by for that. Here's what's happening. Well, another earthquake in Oklahoma. They've had a lot of aftershocks since Saturday's 5.6 hit, but now a 4.7 magnitude earthquake shook Oklahoma again. This is the third large earthquake that rattled the Sooner State in just 3 days. We'll keep our eyes on what's happening in Oklahoma. It sounds a bit like Big Brother. Police can place a GPS device on your car to follow all of your movements for any length of time. The Supreme Court, though, is scheduled to hear arguments about whether investigators need to get a warrant before they can do that. Legal experts say the case, which stems from a D.C. nightclub owner's conviction on drug charges, is one of the most important Fourth Amendment cases in decades and will determine how police conduct investigations and privacy in the high-tech age we now live in. The websites of Israel's military and its intelligence services were down on Sunday, 2 days after a hacker group appeared to threaten the Jewish state over its interception of a Gaza-bound flotilla. The websites of the Israel Defense Forces, one of its intelligence agencies, and the Mossad Foreign Intelligence Service, all unavailable through the day and into the evening. The U.S. Special Forces members who killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in his Pakistan hideout on May 1st, they've revealed how they killed the 9/11 mastermind in a book, The SEAL Target Geronimo, authored by a former SEAL team commander, revealed a version of the killing different from those reported in the press a day after the SEAL Team 6 secretly raided bin Laden's home in Pakistan. In the book, a SEAL radioed the others, Geronimo, 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 upon sighting bin Laden, who saw the Americans and slammed his bedroom door shut. The words meant that he saw the target of the mission. The SEALs kicked open the door of bin Laden's room and found him inside with his youngest wife, Amal. Bin Laden tried to use her as a human shield while he jumped for his AK-47 rifle in his bed. The SEALs fired the first round, hitting the mattress of bin Laden's king-size bed. The second round of gunfire grazed Amal's calf, and it hit bin Laden in the head and chest. And there's also talk that instead of calling him Geronimo, they called him Bert from the Sesame Street character. Douglas Hagman, who monitors websites for us and terrorist sites as well. Douglas, my big question to you is why the difference in the stories from what we heard in May and what these SEALs are now apparently talking about?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that there are numerous answers to that, and we have to select which is the most probable or the most likely answer. And you know, what we've seen here in the past, well, since May 2nd, since the operation went down and the information unfolded, is we've got two different venues of information, the first being the military and intelligence venue, and the second, of course, being the political. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of a mixture between the two. It appears that our people in this administration wanted to take a virtual victory lap after the operation, which doesn't bode well with intelligence gathering. So I think that there was some toes stepped on. And but with respect to the difference in information, I can forgive perhaps the first 24, 48, 72 hours worth of information coming out as being you know, the fog of the operation. But to be honest with you, George, our sources are saying, look, you know, just show me the body, because there are too many different stories, too many different incarnations of the same story. In addition to that, of course, you know, as we have long stated here, there was no proof of life from Osama bin Laden since virtually 2002. So, you know, you combine the two, and of course, you know, makes one question the facts indeed.
And I'm not even sure, Douglas, even with his new book that is out, that we're going to get to the bottom of this one. Joe Frazier, the former heavyweight champion whose furious and intensely personal fights with a taunting Muhammad Ali endured as an epic rivalry in boxing history, has died tonight. Just had a story on yesterday how he was fighting liver disease and cancer. He was 67 years old, and he died in a hospice. Well, that's the singer Adele. She has successfully undergone laser microsurgery on her vocal cords to stop bleeding and prevent possible rupture from a benign polyp. The 23-year-old London-bred Grammy winner was recently forced to cancel the remainder of her tour and appearances this year in support of her sophomore album 21, which is currently on track to become the best-selling release of this year. She's expected to make a full recovery, though no official word from her record label, Columbia, on exactly when she will be well enough to perform and resume singing. Pushed for room and space, a Spanish cemetery has begun placing stickers on thousands of burial sites whose leases are up as a warning to relatives or caretakers to pay up or face possible eviction. So what they'll do is just dig up the caskets and put them out. A Russian police, they've discovered 29 mummies at the home of a well-known local historian who apparently dug up the bodies from cemeteries, dressed them in clothes, scavenged them from graves, and kept them in his house. Imagine the footprint of Neil Armstrong's one giant leap for mankind on the moon being obliterated by hundreds of tourists, or a lunar rover being trashed beyond repair by a joyriding group. NASA has imagined both nightmarish scenarios and has come up with the keep off the grass guidelines for future lunar visitors. They include no fly zones over the first and last moon landing sites, as well as look but don't touch instructions for anyone approaching artifacts left on the moon by NASA's 12 moonwalking astronauts. And even though the likelihood of lunar tourism is still a long way off, NASA has been spurred into giving its directives by the two dozen or more teams competing for the Google Lunar X Prize, which is a $30 million prize for the first privately funded team to safely land a robot on the surface of the moon. Our science advisor, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, do you think all this is necessary?
Well, yeah, if we're going to have tourists, and I think it's going to be a lot closer than that news story makes out. I have got a breaking story to switch to because I want you to be the one to break it. NASA is doing something tonight with the Air Force at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
What are they doing?
Which is just north of you. I have two sources, one in Washington. I can't tell you how high it is, but it's pretty high. And the other is an intel operative in Southern California corroborating that Vandenberg's board is lit. That is a technical term meaning they're preparing for a launch. The rumor is, and we need this confirmed, so I'd like someone at Vandenberg to call you tonight during the hour with Dan Durda maybe on, because this all has to do with YU-55, this asteroid coming by tomorrow afternoon, tomorrow evening. The idea is they are preparing a launch to send either a probe flying past this asteroid as it approaches, or, and this is the really interesting part, it may actually be a warhead designed to deflect it so it does not come within a certain radius of the Earth.
Speculation, or are there some sources here who are telling
you
that?
Well, these are two separate sources. One is in the political structure in Washington. The other is in the intelligence community. And we need confirmation that Vandenberg is preparing to fire an Atlas Centaur to send this spacecraft at high speed to intercept YU-55 sometime between tonight and tomorrow evening.
Well, that's interesting, Richard, because this asteroid is as big as an aircraft carrier. It will dart between the Earth and the Moon Tuesday at 6:28 p.m. Eastern Time. It is going to be the closest encounter by a huge rock in 35 years in a moment. Planetary scientist Daniel Durda joins us, and we'll talk about this asteroid. Well, strike one more blow against UFO believers. The U.S. government apparently is not in contact with any extraterrestrials from other worlds, nor has any confirmed proof of alien life being found, according to White House officials. The message in response to a couple petitions posted on the White House's We the People site, of which one of them, Steve Bassett, of course, the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. Well, Stephen, you got an answer at least, huh?
Oh, absolutely. This is great, George. What has just happened? Maybe a lot of people haven't thought about this yet, but what has just happened is for the first time since this phenomenon exploded into the public reality in early 1947, this is the very first time that an executive branch of the United States government has put out a formal
release, yeah.
release position on this. That is the administration's. This has never happened before. And so now they are pinned to that position. It is a stationary target. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to simply recruit the media to basically break that position because it's indefensible and it's easily shown to be indefensible. The fact that they had never said anything was why they were able to skate so long. So it's already started. I've already logged in 53 articles from around the world covering the petition.
Super.
And I expect by the weekend it'll be over 100. And we're going to put enormous pressure on them. This was either a deliberate or a calculated mistake. But now we have their position, and I think virtually 90% of your audience knows this position is, of course, 35 years out of date and basically completely baseless.
Go for the jugular, Stephen.
Yeah, and we're going to put some real pressure. This is actually a great thing, and I'll have a new petition up probably in about 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks. But in the meantime, we are going to hammer this position really hard, and it's going to get very, very interesting, so pay attention.
Sure is. Stephen Bassett, Paradigm Research Group. You know, going into the second week in a row now, many people are still without power due to major storms, primarily in the Northeast, but it's popping up all over the place. But the new CC Solar Observer from Sea Crane, that is perhaps the best emergency radio you should have. And again, I've said it before, every house, every apartment, every dwelling should have a CC Solar Observer. It's only $49.95. It's got a built-in hand crank solar panel for the power, an AM/FM weather radio, and it's got a flashlight, too, in case something happens. You're in the dark. You don't have to go rummaging around looking for one. There it is. Take advantage of this. Simply go to Sea Crane's website, ccradio.com, and when you do, you can, of course, get all the information you need about this radio or the CC Radio 2, the CC Radio EP, the SW Pocket, all their great radios when you go to ccradio.com or mention my name when you call this toll-free number, 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Well, I've always said it's not a matter of if, but when will we get hit by an asteroid? Could happen tomorrow, could happen a year from now, could not happen in our lifetime. But one day, I'm convinced, it will happen because Earth has been hit before and it'll happen again. Daniel Derda, planetary scientist. And by the way, he's been with me on Coast to Coast now for 10 years. Daniel, isn't it amazing how long you've been with us and how fast time goes by?
Time does fly. Hi, good to talk with you again.
You too.
I guess it was the first night you were on.
Yep, absolutely. Back, I think, April 28th, 2001, in my very first show, and there you were. And we're still talking about asteroids.
Yeah, great to be here again.
This one is as big as an aircraft carrier. That's pretty good size, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, for near-Earth asteroids, for things that come flying by us, that's fairly large. It's still pretty small in the grand scheme of things, but you certainly wouldn't want it falling out of the sky on your town, that's for sure.
200,000 miles away, how close is that in terms of asteroid space?
Well, again, for something of this size, that's darn close. We haven't had something that large fly by the Earth in, you know, gosh, well, I guess the last time was back around 1976 or so. There was an object that was almost exactly that size went zipping through the system. The only thing is we didn't know it at the time because we didn't have the survey telescopes to tell us. We only discovered that object in 2010 and sort of back integrated its orbit and discovered it had made that pass. So things like this of that size don't pass this close that often. It's a pretty rare event.
Can we see it with the naked eye tomorrow?
Unfortunately not, but it's still, it's about maybe, what, 200 or 300 times fainter than you could see with your naked eye. That
yeah.
sounds like a lot, but it's actually not that bad. If you had even a decent-sized backyard, you know, amateur telescope and knew just where to look for it, it'd be kind of fun, actually, to take a peek because, you know, this object is flying, you know, so close to us that it really whizzes through the sky as it goes by. It's actually, at its point of closest approach, it's going to move. It would only take about 3 minutes to move across the, you know, the size of the disk of the moon in the sky. That's pretty much fast enough that you know, staring at it through the telescope, you could kind of get this sense of it actually moving relative to the background stars. That's kind of a fun thing to see.
Richard C. Hoagland, all excited about something going on at Vandenberg, that it could be tied into this asteroid one way or another, either to go up there and try to get some closer pictures of it, who knows what, or maybe even deflect it. What do you think?
Yeah, I heard his comments. I doubt that it. I mean, there may well be some sort of a launch planned at Vandenberg in the next day or two, but I think that would be completely coincidental with the timing of this particular flyby. At least the folks that I talked to, boy, I tell you, we'd be thrilled if we had a chance to get up there and get a spacecraft up there. So I can, you know, given that all the folks that I hang out with in the asteroid community aren't talking about that. I think there's probably something else going on if there's going to be a launch there. But, you know, we're going to do almost as good as a spacecraft encounter anyway tomorrow night. We've already been getting new radar information from this object. It's that's kind of what's so exciting about this for us in the asteroid community is to have an object this large fly that close by gives us a wonderful opportunity to ping radar, bounce radar beams off this thing, and learn a lot more about its shape and its rotation and what this kind of asteroid is like. I mean, you know, you got a picture. This is something the size of a small mountain, good-sized city block.
It's quarter mile long, right?
Well, yeah, we're going to be seeing, and it's out there, 85% the distance out to the moon, so it's pretty far out, and we're going to be seeing stuff on the surface the size of minivans. That's how good the radar data are going to be from this thing. It's almost as good as sending a spacecraft out to the asteroid to take pictures of it.
What would happen, Daniel, if this asteroid didn't hit us but hit the moon? Anything?
I think something that big. I mean, on the Earth, it'd make a crater about four miles across.
Whoa.
Similar on the moon, and that's a big enough event. We'd see it from the Earth. That would be a spectacular thing to be able to watch. It'd be nature's biggest, laboratory experiment in impact cratering. I can tell you that would be absolutely thrilling from my point of view. But it's making a close approach with the moon as it passes by the Earth as well, but only similar distance. So we know that's not a danger.
Would it smash into the moon to the point where it would send moon rock to us?
There's certainly a possibility. I'm not sure it would get here immediately, but an impact of that scale would probably loft some material off the moon, to the point where it completely escaped the moon. That's always a small fraction of whatever gets sent off. But we do get moon rocks here on the Earth all the time in the form of lunar meteorites, and so an event of this size would do something like that. Interesting for sure.
Why are so many people interested in this? Is it because of its size and its proximity?
Yeah, I think that it's exactly that combination that makes it such a rare event, and so that's what's made it rather newsworthy. And, again, from our point of view, it's an exciting opportunity to learn about this class of, a representative of this class of objects that, obviously can and do and, have hit us in the past. And, imagine... I think the other thing that's so interesting about this is that, you can sort of kind of stretch your mind a little bit and put yourself out there as a crew member on a mission that, this is the kind of object that we'd be very interested in visiting with a human crew because it's passing near through the Earth's system. It makes it pretty easy to get to. So
just jump off it after you're done, huh?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what's so fun about these little objects is they have such low gravity that it makes them, in some senses, a lot more easy to explore. You don't have to worry about, to go to the moon, you've got to get your spacecraft going fast to get off the Earth. But, to get onto the surface of the moon, you've got to slow down again. You've got to, use up all that energy again in the other direction. And these little objects, all you have to do is go out, rendezvous with them. You don't have to... You're not slowing down to land. You're going out, matching speeds, hanging out for a while, doing your study, and then back to Earth. So it, in some ways, energetically, some of these things are easier to get to than the moon.
What do you think of my thoughts? It's not if, but when.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. We know there's no danger from this object right now, and actually, as we can track its orbit out for the for the sort of foreseeable future on the sort of century sort of timeline, but. The very fact that this object is making a close approach to the Earth now means it probably has in the past and, long into the distance will. And if not this object, objects like it, absolutely, absolutely, we're going to be hit by one of these things one of these days.
They say this object hasn't been this close in 200 years. How do they know? Nobody's been around that long.
Right. Well, that's the beauty of the radar observations that we have just been getting now since about, about April back last year. You know, we've known about this object for a good, six years or so now. It was discovered back in 2005. But it was discovered optically, right, with optical telescopes.
Right.
And you can only do so much with the positional information on the sky that you get from those optical telescopes. We can, you get a fairly decent orbit from those things, from those observations, and that allows you to, it's the trajectory through the sky and through time. You can integrate forward, calculate forward and backward where that object has been and where it's going to be going. But there's always some uncertainty on that, and that uncertainty in where the object is or was grows the farther away from the current epoch that you try to look at the orbit. So the uncertainty in where how many close approaches it made to the Earth and so on grows. But the beauty of radar is it really bangs down the uncertainty in where that object is, close to us or far away in the sky as you look at it. And so radar is an extremely powerful tool to get much better precision on the orbits of these things.
Well, don't jump on an asteroid, Daniel. Stay with us. We're going to take calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, a question that many are looking for the answer, who's Alex Jones? We'll give you the answer in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come right back, we'll take your phone calls with the planetary scientist Daniel Derta as we talk about asteroids right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Daniel Derta. Daniel, does an asteroid have its own gravitational field?
You have your own gravitational field. Anything with mass does. The more massive, the bigger the object, the more gravity it has. So something like this object, 2005 YU55, will have a very feeble gravity. But it would be so little, though, you really wouldn't be able to effectively stand or walk on its surface. That's how little it would be.
You'd float away?
You'd be slowly, it's very slightly bound to it, but so feebly that your feet couldn't even get traction onto the surface. There just wouldn't be enough downward pressure to get enough friction to actually even make a step forward. It'd be far more efficient just to sort of gingerly, push off with your fingertips and just sort of just slowly glide almost effortlessly across the surface.
If you were on the surface of an asteroid, a bunch of astronauts, would they feel speed, whatever speed it was moving at?
If it was a rapidly rotating object, like many of them are, some of these objects spin with, the day on these objects is only about, maybe 2 or 3 hours long in some of the more extreme cases. That might give you a sense of, the sky changing, the orientation of the stars or the position of the sunlight changing much more rapidly than you're used to here on the Earth. But in terms of actually your sense of the speed through the, through interplanetary space, not much more so than we do right, here on the surface of the Earth. These objects are in the near-Earth environment, so they're traveling around the sun at a speed similar to the Earth's, 30 kilometers every second. So. But you would probably not sense that. I think it'd be more the rotation of the object than anything.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to Mark in Lake Tahoe, California, west of the Rockies. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hey, Mark.
Hi. I've been listening to your show for 12 years at least.
Oh, thank
really
you,
appreciate
sir.
Your service.
Thanks.
I have a question for your guest. If this object were to pass, is it possible that it could pass through our atmosphere? Something like this, or would it bounce off, or what would it do to our weather? What would the effect be?
It's not coming that close, but Dan, what would get it that close? Anything?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Boy, that'd be quite the show, actually. We saw an object much smaller than this, but a similar passing object actually passed through the atmosphere over the Tetons back in the 1970s. I forgot the exact date. It was actually caught on somebody's home movie camera back at that time. Looked like a pretty brilliant fireball passing over the Tetons, and then it literally skipped back out of the atmosphere again, kind of like a throw a rock across the water at the right angle. This object's pretty big though. I would imagine Well, this object's probably big enough to have a what we call a regolith on its surface. It's probably got some loose rocks and gravelly and dusty debris bound to its surface by its, you know, very feeble gravity. But if that were to actually pass through the atmosphere, a lot of that would get stripped off. It'd be a pretty interesting light show before, you know, skipping back out to space if it came in on a very glancing angle.
Why doesn't, you know, the thing's only 200,000 miles away when it gets here tomorrow.
Yeah.
Why doesn't our gravity suck it in, pull it in?
Well, in a sense, it is. It's being, you know, sped up just a little bit as it goes, you know, past the Earth-Moon system. But that's still pretty far out from its point of view. I mean, it's zipping through at a pretty good rate. So it certainly does feel that tug, but it's pretty feeble that far out. If it were, you know, as close as, for instance, Apophis is going to pass by us in 2029, that one is much closer. That's still outside the atmosphere, but inside the orbit of our geosynchronous satellite.
That's like, 56,000 miles, I think.
Yeah, it's much closer.
Like,
and so that one is, you know, that's going to more significantly bend the trajectory of Apophis in 2029. So this is close. This object tomorrow is pretty close, but not so close that it's having that big an effect on the trajectory.
If this object, which is an aircraft carrier sized asteroid, smashed into the ocean, mm-hmm. What kind of tsunami do you think, and I'm sure there have been models, what kind of tsunami?
The models are a little sketchy on that because the tsunamis that are generated from an impact splash have a different form, a different character than the tsunamis that we're used to from the shift in the crustal plates that we get during an earthquake. And so some of our models have a little bit of a hard time trying to figure that out exactly, but it's pretty clear that an object of this size, that would be, I mean, no matter what the uncertainty in the models, the answer is still, it'd be very devastating.
100-foot-high tsunami, maybe?
I would say probably pretty easily. I mean, you know, you think about the sort of numbers we saw for the really horrible tsunami back in 2004 in December in Indonesia. We're talking tsunami at least comparable to that, and you know, probably a little bit bigger.
Yikes! Let's go to Tom, New York, New York, on the wild card line. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Okay, good to have you with us.
Good. Well, in reference to what your guest is saying, I want to make a note of a famous Zulu prophet from South Africa saying a comet or asteroid is supposed to be coming this way next year.
Mm-hmm.
He predict. I want to actually guess if you've ever heard of it, this notation. The prophet's name is Gugu Letu Lubuntu. And he says that sometime in 2012, this asteroid comet is supposed to come through our solar system.
Do we know anything, Daniel, that could get even closer than that at this point?
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular, you know, prophecy prediction. There's a lot of those out there flying around with regards to 2012. I wonder how closely related
right.
that might be to some of the others there. But, you know, again, there's little objects like this passing by the Earth all the time. I mean, literally every single day.
That we don't even know about until they've gone past us.
That we do not even know about. At any given moment, there's an object passing between us and the moon that's about the size of your, you know, your kitchen or your living room. And that happens every single day. We just don't know about it.
See, that's the scary part. We literally, if we don't know about them, we could get hit by them, right? In theory.
Absolutely. I mean, we're doing a lot better. I mean, the surveys, in fact, we've just learned in the last few months as NASA's WISE mission, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which was out there orbiting the Earth for the last year and a half or so, doing all kinds of cool infrared astronomy, studying the structure of the distant universe and so on. But a great byproduct is that object was that satellite was able to detect little warm objects in the Earth neighborhood, right? So it's very good at detecting some of these near-Earth asteroids, that some of which are dark but very warm, which is, you know, what an infrared telescope is good at doing. That telescope just recently told us that the total number of near-Earth objects in the population near the Earth is actually a little smaller than we were projecting based on our optical studies. So if anything, that's a bit of a comfort, but that But that doesn't, that still doesn't mean that we've discovered all the ones that are out there yet. And so, you know, by all means, there's still the possibility that one of these little guys will creep up on us, you know, on its final plunge in, and we won't know about it for, you know, it's like, gosh, you know, a couple months.
A little late. Let's go east of the Rockies, Bill, West Hartford, Connecticut. Amateur astronomer, if I recall, right, Bill?
Correct. Yes, Dr. Derda, hi. As an amateur astronomer myself, I'm very much concerned about what Robert Zubrin said recently on COAST regarding NASA's Mars unmanned exploration program. He had said that this month's Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity, as well as 2013's MAVEN Mars Orbiter, will be the last two missions to Mars for about a generation, 20 years or more, because of the budgetary situation. Is that true, do you know? And secondly, do you know what can be done by us amateur astronomers to get the James Webb Space Telescope launched in 2018 and not canceled?
Well, actually, probably those two are actually linked together. Part of the problems we're having budget-wise are unfortunately due to both MSL and James Webb, it turns out, unfortunately. The overruns on those have hit pretty hard. There's some truth to what I think Bob was trying to make his point in a rather extreme way to kind of get attention to this. But that said, there's some kernel of truth to what he actually had to say. Things are pretty extreme there because of the overrun. So we're all kind of nervous about what's going to be, you know, happening, not just from the missions point of view, but also to what we call the RNA budget, the research and analysis budget. That's the tiny fraction of the sort of dollars that we're talking about here that actually fund, you know, the cadre of all the scientists and researchers out there that are actually making use of the data and giving us context for what all these spacecraft are finding. It's hard times, and there's actually some desperation out there.
Isn't this being penny wise and pound foolish?
Well, in the overall scheme of things, absolutely. You know, we're worried about $300 million here, or you know, in some cases even slightly bigger numbers, but. You know, even the a few billions that we're talking about within NASA's budget, as we all well know, it's pennies under the cushion compared to the trillions and trillions that we're in trouble with in other places.
Let's go to Rick now in Denver, Colorado. First time caller, Rick, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George.
Hey.
Great to talk to you. It's been a while. I've been trying to get in for ages. Thanks. Just two quick questions that I can take the answer off the air. There, the track of U-55 has changed several times in the last few months, and I'm just wondering if. Mm-hmm. If that is going to be the case tomorrow, the next day, not saying it would ever hit Earth or anything, but possible moon strike. And my second question is the circular nature of the comet. It doesn't seem to match any of the other, you know, circular comets in the past. And thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome. Maybe it's a real aircraft carrier.
Those are more oblong than this thing.
That's right.
Sure.
It's
very good question.
The Federation.
So indeed, the track, the orbit of this object has changed a little bit over time. Not physically, just our understanding of the shape of it, and that gets back to this issue of the uncertainty in the orbit that I was describing. When all we had available were the optical data, where you saw most of those changes occurring was as a result back in April last year, in 2010. When we got our first radar observations, and that all of a sudden collapsed a lot of the uncertainty we had in that orbit. So those changes were only apparent. The object itself wasn't physically changing its motion. It was
okay.
Just our understanding.
Are you excited about this arrival tomorrow?
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, people in my department, one of my fellow astronomers from here in Boulder, he's actually not in Boulder tonight. He's in Hawaii getting ready to do some observations with the big telescopes there. My friends at Arecibo and the Goldstone radar facilities in Puerto Rico and California are warming up the tubes, if you will, to get all these wonderful radar data. They just released a new image today, in fact, that shows even more this beautiful sort of circular shape of this object, which, you know, a lot of these things are lumpy and potato-shaped, but there's a fair fraction of near-Earth asteroids that actually are rather round and spherical, and that's because they've been sort of shaped by Earth tides and Earth encounters in the past.
And are these all asteroids that have originated from the asteroid belt between?
Yeah, that's the main reservoir. These are all escapees from that main reservoir. They get tugged and pulled around by the orbits of, you know, by the mass of Jupiter and Strangely enough, actually, over time, even by the action of just sunlight shining on them, can change their orbit and cause them to wander into these orbital resonances with Jupiter, which, you know, it's not like you see on the TV shows where one rock bounces into another rock and the one goes click and all
yeah.
it comes to the Earth. That's not how it happens. It's a slow motion, gradual change in the shape of the orbit because of gravity and sunlight.
Do these asteroids ever leave the solar system and just
yes,
keep going?
Yeah, a lot of them do. In fact, some of them make such close approaches with Jupiter that they get flung literally completely out of the solar system, spit out to the to interstellar space. A good fraction of them get changed into orbits which dive so close to the sun that they either evaporate on passing so close to the sun, or they just dive and plunge right into the sun itself. So
wow.
a lot of these objects actually meet their deaths this way.
And what about asteroids that come into the solar system? Does that happen?
There should be, you know, based on what we're spitting out to interstellar space, and given what we're learning now about how prevalent planets and planetary systems are around other stars, this process of birthing planets around these dirty disks around young stars is a very messy process. And as the big planets are accreting in those systems, they spit out the gravitational close encounters with those new planets, spit out a lot of this debris. Interstellar space is probably pretty full of debris like asteroids and even small planets that have been spit out. So some of them must certainly at some point or another pass through our solar system.
I still believe that a major league planet between Mars and Jupiter blew up, and these are the remnant pieces.
Well, that was the old idea, and when the first couple asteroids were discovered in the 1800s, that was the original idea. We've come to understand, based on the samples that we've gotten back from these things, not only from spacecraft, but the tons and tons of them that fall all the time on us from the meteorites, that tells the tale of a relatively unprocessed material that never really grew to something too big. But certainly big planetary collisions did occur in the early solar system.
But they got to the rock stage at a certain point.
Oh, clearly.
Okay.
Yeah, clearly.
It wasn't like they were floating around as gases by themselves.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, the very fact that we get these solid hunks of rock that fall on us that are, every bit as, some of them are solid steel. I mean, they're nature's stainless steel. That tells the story that at least some of these things grew into little mini protoplanets, which differentiated and formed little nickel iron cores, and then were bashed apart in some of these collisions between asteroids again to liberate that stuff and eventually send it to the Earth. So, I mean, they're absolutely fascinating pieces, these meteorites. I mean, it fascinates me still that anybody can go to any museum or store, pick up a piece of a meteorite, and you've got to let your brain and your mind make that journey that meteorite made over billions of years and millions and millions of miles, to tell this story of these bashed apart, cratered little worldlets, and you're holding it in your hand. It's amazing.
And it's in theory 14 billion years old, at least.
The whole universe, yeah, just a hair under 14
yeah.
billion. The solar system's a bit younger than that, but still ancient compared to anything we
But
know
the
that.
Particles are there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They don't get used up. They stick around.
Let's go to Bob in Los Angeles. Go ahead, Bob. We'll squeeze you in here.
Okay, yeah, I remember Ronald Reagan stating, "What if we were threatened by something above?" I think he was talking about a hit strike there, not the UFO thing. If you remember that,
yep, I sure do.
Yeah, I think he was talking about some asteroid or something. But anyway, I was just wondering the old Mayan thing, then 2012 thing. That we're getting close to 2012, and I've been noticing every month approaching 2012, we get threats. Hearing. That object's going to hit us, this object's going to hit us, that. It just seems like we're going through some sort of maybe some asteroid belt. We've been seeing a lot more activity heading toward our planet, just like last week. I saw tons of falling stars, on Halloween. On the 31st here in California, large objects were falling to the sky. Is there really are we going through some sort of asteroid belt or something? Is that why we're experiencing a lot of activities?
Well, nothing different than we see all the time from the physical point of view. I mean, I think what you're seeing is a selection effect in the reporting of interesting stories as 2012 is coming close. That's just from my point of view working in the field. I kind of see behind the scenes. I mean, there's a lot of these little things that never really make the news all the time. So. You know, from my point of view, it's kind of the, I hate to say it this way, but it's the same old, but it certainly is an interesting same old.
Daniel, if this thing goes by tomorrow without any major story, we'll let it pass. But if something happens, we'll get you back on, okay?
That would be wonderful.
Daniel Derna, planetary scientist. I'm George Norrie, and I'll be back in a moment with a big question. Who's Alex Jones?